Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are focusing on one of the most critical, yet I think often really misunderstood, periods of human development. We're talking about ages 4 to 6.
The kindergarten years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's this formative bridge between, you know, preschool play and the start of formal schooling. And we're going to be dissecting the findings from the UDAM Research Kindergarten from First Principles Initiative.
Which is, I mean, it's an exhaustive assembly of research. We're talking meta-analyses, randomized controlled trials, longitudinal data, all designed to just cut through the noise.
Right.
Our mission here really is to move past the conventional wisdom, the things we think are true, and actually extract the highest leverage variables that influence long-term success for a child.
And when you look at this age group, that core tension, it just jumps right out at you.
It really does.
You see this massive disconnect between what developmental science shows we should be prioritizing, these deep cognitive process skills, and what institutional priorities actually measure.
And what they incentivize.
Right. And those are usually the easily testable short-term content skills.
It's the difference between asking if a child knows the alphabet today versus asking if they have the cognitive architecture, the resilience to graduate high school in 15 years. It's a completely different question.
We're talking about a developmental window where the prefrontal cortex, which is basically the brain's CEO, is just maturing at this incredible rate.
It's an inflection point.
And if we miss that optimal chance to set that developmental trajectory, the consequences are, well, they're profound. We need to figure out what inputs act as those true high-leverage multipliers for life.
Exactly. So this deep dive is really our shortcut to understanding the foundational mechanics of learning and behavior during this incredibly important time.
Okay, so let's start with that foundational concept. It's a term that comes up again and again in the research. Executive function, or EF.
The linchpin.
It really is.
Yeah.
Before we even get into why it's so important, we have to define it clearly. What exactly are we talking about? The research points to three domain general processes that make up EF.
Right. So EF is, it's essentially the brain's air traffic control system.
I like that analogy.
It's what allows us to manage complex tasks and regulate our own behavior. And we can break it down into three core components. First, you have working memory.
Okay.
This is your ability to not just hold, but to actively manipulate information in your mind. Think about remembering a multi-step instruction, like go to your room, get your blue shoes, and meet me by the door.
So it's not just a storage locker, it's a workbench.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's an active workbench. The second component is inhibitory control.
So the brakes.
The brakes, exactly. It's the capacity to suppress a strong, but maybe inappropriate impulse to resist distractions or to stop an automatic response. The classic example is a game like Red Light, Green Light, where you have to slam the brakes on your own movement.
Or not shouting out the answer in class.
Or not shouting out the answer, yes. And then the third piece is cognitive flexibility.
Which is about shifting gears.
Precisely. Sometimes it's called attention shifting. It's that mental skill that lets you switch between different tasks or different sets of rules really quickly. So, for example, you might be sorting a deck of cards by color. And then the rule changes, and now you have to immediately switch to sorting them by shape. That mental pivot is cognitive flexibility. And these three things, they work together to form the basis of what we call self-regulation.
Okay, so why the urgent focus on this specific age range, 4 to 6? Is there something special happening in the brain? What's this neurodevelopmental shift we're seeing?
It's a genuine structural transformation. It's all rooted in the physical maturation of the prefrontal cortex. The research shows a really stark difference between a 3-year-old brain and a 6-year-old brain in this area.
How so?
Before age 4, children tend to operate under what researchers call a one-factor, undifferentiated model of EF.
Okay, that sounds technical. What does a one-factor, undifferentiated model actually look like in, you know, a real kid? The sources say the skills are mushy together.
Mushy together is a great way to think about it. It basically means that for a 3-year-old, if they struggle with one component, say, inhibitory control.
The brakes.
Right, the brakes. They're likely going to struggle with all of them, including working memory. Their cognitive control processes are all kind of bundled together. So if they get distracted.
Or inhibitory control.
Then the information they were holding in their working memory just poof, it crashes immediately. There's no separation of duties yet. The engine is running as one single unit.
I see. So a distraction doesn't just pull their attention, it completely wipes the slate clean.
Exactly. But by age 6, that system starts to differentiate. Working memory, in particular, achieves enough autonomy that it can coordinate complex tasks without immediately collapsing just because of a small inhibitory lapse.
And this signals real physical changes in the brain.
It does. It signals the rapid myelination and synaptic pruning that's happening in the prefrontal cortex. The data is just crystal clear on this. The gains in self-regulation, that broader ability to manage your emotions, your attention, your behavior, during the ages of 3 to 6, are among the most dramatic of the entire human lifespan.
Wow.
It really is the peak neuroplastic window for building our cognitive control system.
Which means if we can boost EF during this window, that investment should pay dividends for decades.
It should.
And this is where the research gets, I think, really stunning. We're talking about the long shadow of EF. The idea that EF measured around age 4 acts as this high leverage multiplier that can predict outcomes across a person's entire life.
Right. And the scope of that prediction is what makes this research so compelling. It's not just the small effect. Early childhood EF is a consistent predictor of 25 distinct outcomes across the lifespan.
25. And we're not just talking about getting good grades.
No, not at all. These are metrics that really shape a person's entire life trajectory. We're talking about employment, physical health, criminal behavior, mental health. It's all connected back to this early foundation.
Let's unpack that mechanism a little bit.
Yeah.
How does a child's ability to, say, resist blurting out an answer at age 5? How does that actually translate to something like employment stability at age 30?
It all comes down to the capacity for goal-directed behavior. Take inhibitory control, like you said. As an adult, that same skill manifests as the ability to defer gratification.
Okay.
It's the ability to save money instead of making an impulse buy, or to resist reacting emotionally in a high-stakes negotiation at work. That persistent effort, that control, translates directly into things like employment stability and financial success.
And working memory.
A strong working memory at age 5 becomes the capacity to handle complex project management as an adult. It's about synthesizing huge amounts of information, learning advanced new skills quickly in the workplace, all of which are very strong predictors of your final adult educational attainment.
And health was one of the outcomes you mentioned. How does that connect?
The correlation is incredibly strong. Poor EF in childhood predicts a whole range of poor health outcomes in adulthood, including higher rates of substance abuse and obesity.
Why?
Because self-regulation governs thousands of tiny daily decisions. It's choosing the salad over the fast food. It's sticking to an exercise routine even when you don't feel like it. It's adhering to a complicated medical regimen from your doctor.
So all of these adult willpower behaviors are really rooted in that childhood capacity for cognitive control.
That's right. When we talk about maximizing a child's potential, we are, in a very real sense, talking about maximizing this control system.
And that really reframes the whole purpose of early learning, doesn't it? Yeah. It's not just about academics. It's a life skills curriculum.
It is. And speaking of that, let's bring in a connection that I think is really non-obvious for a lot of people. Motor competence and embodied cognition.
Right, because most of us think of EF as purely a mental thing, something that happens inside your head. But the sources show this really strong link to physical skills.
Yes, the physical pathway to cognitive growth. This supports what's known as the embodied cognition approach, the basic idea that our physical movements and how we interact with the world literally shape our cognitive structures.
So using your body strengthens your brain CEO.
It does. There was a specific study of 5- and 6-year-olds that found motor inhibition. So the physical control needed to execute a very precise, non-automatic movement or just to freeze your body on command. That skill had the largest effect size in predicting their manual dexterity skills later on.
So if you train a child to be physically controlled, to stop, to start, to balance carefully, you are directly exercising that inhibitory control muscle in the brain.
Precisely. The cognitive demand is rooted in the physical effort. Think about simple modified games. If you play Simon Says, you're constantly activating your inhibitory control by suppressing that automatic urge to move when Simon doesn't say. Or if you give a child structured puzzles that require fine motor control and just a little bit more effort than they're used to, you're strengthening the feedback loop between their physical effort and their cognitive control systems. It's a surprisingly efficient way to develop control without needing a lot of abstract instruction.
Okay, let's pivot from that foundational control system to actual academic outcomes. Because when educators and parents look at a 5-year-old, they're almost always worried most about reading readiness.
It's the number one concern.
It is. But the data from the landmark Duncan study completely flipped that script. This was a 2007 meta-analysis, and it was huge, tracking thousands of children across six massive longitudinal data sets. And it asked a simple question: what kindergarten entry skills are the strongest predictors of later academic success?
And the finding was genuinely counterintuitive. I mean, it shocked the early childhood education field.
What was the assumption going in?
The consensus assumption was that early literacy skills or maybe general social adjustment would be the top predictors. That just seemed obvious. But the data revealed that the strongest, most consistent predictor of later academic achievement, all the way up to high school, was a child's early math skills.
Stronger than early reading.
Stronger than early reading ability, and far, far stronger than general measures of social emotional competence.
Early math is greater than early reading. That feels like a headline. So why do we as a culture prioritize reading so heavily if math seems to be the bigger lever for long-term success?
I think it's because reading is often seen as the gateway, right? The necessary entry point to all other content. Plus, early reading progress, things like letter recognition, are just easier to measure.
Mm-hmm.
But math skills at age five, we're talking about things like number sense, understanding more and less, basic spatial reasoning. Those skills are highly correlated with the very cognitive processes we were just talking about.
Executive function.
Math is inherently a problem-solving exercise that demands working memory and cognitive flexibility. The specific predictor hierarchy that Duncan and his colleagues found was early math first, then early reading, and then attention skills.
Okay, let's zoom in on attention skills for a second, because that's our process skill sitting right there under the content skill of math. What kind of predictive power are we actually looking at?
Attention skills showed the second strongest prediction overall. The average correlation was R equals 0.42 for later reading and R equals 0.34 for later math.
Okay, we need to translate that. When you say R equals 0.42, what does that actually mean for a listener? Is that a big deal?
It's a very big deal. In the world of social science and developmental prediction, a correlation of 0.42 is considered robust, moderate, and highly reliable. You see it consistently across diverse populations.
Well, it's not a fluke.
Not at all.
It suggests that if we were able to intervene and improve a child's attention scores by one standard deviation, which is a major but achievable shift, we could expect a highly significant, predictable improvement in their later reading scores. It's not a trivial relationship. It means attention skills are powerful causal drivers of later literacy.
And what about other EF components?
Working memory also showed a really strong effect. An overall effect size of G equals 0.370 for predicting academic performance in primary school. So, yes, ES is absolutely foundational.
So if I'm hearing you right, the process skills are highly leveraged, but they're often expressed through academic content. And math just happens to be the most cognitively demanding content we test at that early age.
That is one really critical interpretation, but we have to be careful here and address the socio-emotional nuance.
Okay.
Because the Duncan study's initial report was sometimes misinterpreted to mean that, you know, social skills don't matter at all for success. And that's a huge oversimplification.
Right. How do we maintain rigor here? Because we know social-emotional learning is vital, but how does it connect specifically to academic scores?
So when Duncan's team looked at these general measures of socio-emotional behaviors, things like cooperation, social skills, internalizing problems like anxiety, or externalizing problems like aggression, those measures were generally found to be statistically insignificant as predictors of later academic performance.
Okay.
However, and this is the crucial caveat, that socio-emotional skills predict a host of other really important outcomes, things like mental health, general well-being, peer acceptance, and reducing disciplinary issues later on.
So they are distinct levers. If you want a happy, well-adjusted child, you focus on those SE skills. If you want a child who's going to ace the third grade reading test, you focus on early math and attention.
They are distinct, but they're also deeply interconnected. A really rigorous reanalysis of the data showed that when they properly accounted for missing data, which is a common problem in these big longitudinal studies, specific kindergarten SE behaviors did significantly predict third grade outcomes.
Which ones?
Specifically, low hyperactivity and impulsivity, which is an EF skill, and high prosocial behavior. Those showed clear significance for later academics. So EF skills, which are inherently self-regulatory, really act as the bridge between the social and academic worlds.
This sounds less like a one-way street, more like a feedback loop. Let's talk about bidirectionality. Do poor academics cause behavioral problems, or is it the other way around?
It is a powerful two-way street. The evidence absolutely supports that feedback loop model. There was a really compelling study that showed that children who had reading problems in first grade were significantly more likely to display poor task engagement, poor self-control, and increased behavioral problems by third grade.
That is fascinating. So the cognitive frustration of not being able to read actually leads to an emotional regulation failure.
Exactly. The lack of mastery becomes a major psychological stressor. When a task is consistently too difficult, the EF system gets overwhelmed, and that leads to withdrawal or frustration or acting out. The poor academic skill generated the behavioral problem.
And this highlights why early effective intervention is so critical.
Mm-hmm.
You're stabilizing both the academic trajectory and the child's behavioral control system at the same time.
You're stopping that negative reinforcement cycle before it gets entrenched.
That whole idea of bidirectionality leads us directly into what I think is the fundamental intellectual distinction in all this research. And that's the difference between content knowledge and process skills, and what each of them ultimately predicts for a child.
Right. We can establish a really clear framework here using two simple concepts: status and trajectory.
Okay.
So content mastery, that's your early literacy, early numeracy, vocabulary, general knowledge. That predicts a child's initial status.
Meaning how smoothly they start school, where they are on day one compared to their peers.
Exactly. What is their immediate starting academic competence? Knowing your letters and numbers gives you a good starting status, but then you have the process skills.
EF, self-regulation.
Yes. And crucially, a category called Approaches to Learning, or ATL.
What's that?
ATL is a specific collection of observable behaviors. It's things like attentiveness, persistence, eagerness, motivation, learning independence. And these skills, they predict a child's trajectory.
And trajectory is their capacity for growth over time, regardless of where they started.
Precisely. Content mastery might get you an initial lead in the race, but process skills determine if you can maintain momentum, if you can adapt when the course gets difficult, and if you can close gaps.
And there was a study that tracked this over the long term.
Yes, a longitudinal study that tracked kids for 6 years. It found that only approaches to learning significantly influenced a student's ability to transition across the different achievement categories.
So if a child started in the struggling group, it was their ATL score, their persistence and eagerness, that determined if they could move up to average or high achievement over those 6 years.
That is exactly what it found. If a struggling child has high persistence, high attentiveness, they are just better able to receive and use feedback. They can correct their errors. They can withstand the frustration of academic failure. Process skills provide the capacity for self-correction and the sustained effort that's needed for real, deep, long-term learning. Without them, even a high initial status can erode very quickly once the material gets challenging.
This brings us back to that really compelling and I think highly non-obvious connection we mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
the bidirectional math amplifier.
Mm-hmm.
We established that EF predicts math success. That makes sense. But the reverse, the idea that math instruction actually strengthens EF, that feels like a huge intellectual leap.
It is, and the data backs it up really powerfully. So while, yes, self-regulatory skills are a prerequisite for being able to focus on a math problem,
right,
the very act of engaging in developmentally rigorous, high-quality, complex math instruction actively demands and therefore strengthens executive function over time.
And tell us again about that shocking data point, the one about the strength of that reverse relationship.
This is what's so fascinating. In some of these sophisticated cross-lag studies, they found that the predictive strength of the math to EF direction was significantly stronger than the EF to math direction.
Wow. So what's the implication of that?
It implies that if our goal is to improve a child's working memory and their cognitive flexibility, one of the single most effective things we can do is provide them with structured, challenging math activities.
Okay, I want to push back on that a little bit, because I think when people hear math for five-year-olds, they picture rote memorization counting to 100 or simple addition worksheets. Is that the kind of math that amplifies EF?
Absolutely not. And the sources are very clear on this. Rote memorization and simple calculation, they just don't demand high-level cognitive control. The kind of math that amplifies EF is instruction that's designed to challenge the systems.
Like what?
Things like number sense, patterning, and spatial reasoning.
Can you give us a concrete example? How does something like spatial reasoning challenge a kid's cognitive flexibility?
Sure. Think about patterning. If a child is shown a complex sequence, like red, blue, blue, green, and then asked what comes next, they have to hold that entire sequence in their working memory.
Okay.
While simultaneously applying the rule set to figure out the next step. That's cognitive flexibility. A more complex example would be using manipulatives, like blocks, to explore volume or area. The child has to constantly switch their attention between the physical attributes of the block, its shape, and its numerical attributes, the count of the blocks, all while trying to solve a problem.
I see. It's that constant shifting, holding information, and inhibiting the simple wrong answers.
That's the cognitive workout. That's what builds the EF system.
Mm-hmm.
In this model, high-quality math isn't just content delivery. It's a potent catalyst for cognitive development.
Okay, so if we accept that the what to teach is a combination of EF and high-quality math, the research on how to teach it is equally, if not more, crucial. And this brings us to what the research calls the implementation paradox. This is the story of the Tools of the Mind curriculum, which is this incredible case study of both spectacular success and spectacular failure.
It's the same program.
The exact same program. And this paradox is probably the most sobering finding for anyone who's trying to translate science into real-world practice.
It really is. So Tools of the Mind is a well-regarded curriculum. It's explicitly designed to foster EF and self-regulation through what they call Vygotskian-based intentional and scaffolded play activities. The science behind it is very sound.
But the results in the real world were anything but consistent.
The variation in the effect sizes was staggering. It ranged from 0.0 to 0.8 standard deviations.
And that range was based almost entirely on implementation quality.
Almost entirely. Now let's frame that number for a second. An effect size of 0.8 SD in educational research is monumental.
It's huge.
It's among the largest, most powerful effects you will ever see in an early childhood intervention. It suggests that when this curriculum is delivered with high fidelity, it can drastically change a child's developmental trajectory. And that effect was particularly strong for lower-income children, which was shown in the Blair and Raver study in 2014.
So that's the spectacular success story. But then you have the Head Start CARES trial.
The spectacular failure. In that large-scale, randomized controlled trial, the exact same Tools of the Mind curriculum showed no better EF outcomes than the control group.
Zero effect.
A zero effect size. And the reason was that the teachers who were assigned to the tools condition scored the lowest on implementation fidelity compared to teachers who were implementing the other interventions in that same trial.
Okay, so what were these low-fidelity teachers missing? What's the practical difference between just letting kids have free play and this Vygotskian-based intentional play?
The difference is the scaffolding and the intentionality. In the tools curriculum, the play centers aren't just, you know, spaces for free choice. They're highly structured environments. Children are explicitly taught to use cognitive tools.
Like what?
Like private speech, which is talking themselves through a problem out loud. Or mediation tools, like using a picture checklist or a timer to guide their actions. And crucially, children are required to use planning centers before they can even enter dramatic play.
So they have to plan out their play first.
They have to. They must plan their roles, plot out the sequence of events, and define the rules of their play scenario before they begin.
That planning process, I mean, that sounds like it would demand massive amounts of working memory, inhibitory control, and cognitive flexibility.
It absolutely does. It forces the child to project into the future, to adhere to a rule set that they themselves defined, and to manage the complexity of social interaction. These are all incredibly EF-intensive tasks.
So the low-fidelity teachers, they were likely just missing that intentional scaffolding.
That's the hypothesis. They probably reverted to more passive supervision or just allowed the play to become aimless. And in doing so, they lost the very mechanism by which the curriculum was supposed to exercise executive function.
So the critical lesson here isn't just about the curriculum you choose, but about the deep, ingrained understanding and training of the staff who deliver it.
Absolutely. The research concludes that curriculum selection is secondary to implementation quality and even the personal characteristics of the program leaders. If teachers don't internalize the why, that the goal is EF training through play, not just, you know, having kids put on a fun show, the whole program collapses.
So beyond just this one curriculum, what does the broader science tell us about the malleability of EF? I mean, can we actually train these core cognitive skills effectively?
Yes, we can. A big comprehensive meta-analysis of 32 different studies on cognitive training for preschoolers. It yielded an overall effect size of G equals 0.352.
Which is good.
It's a moderate, meaningful, and highly actionable effect size. It confirms that EF is definitely trainable with the right interventions.
And who benefits the most from this kind of training?
The data shows really powerful targeted effectiveness. these interventions were substantially more effective for at-risk children.
So kids with diagnosed conditions like ADHD or children from low socioeconomic backgrounds.
Exactly. More effective for them than for typically developing children who don't have those associated risks. And this is really an equity finding. It tells us that specialized high-fidelity EF training is a crucial tool for mitigating compounding disadvantages. It provides a powerful boost right where it's needed the most.
And besides these formal curricula, what other specific modalities have popped up in the data as being potent EF boosters?
We found several different approaches that were backed by strong evidence. First, mindfulness-based interventions. Something called integrated body-mind training, or IBMT. It showed significant increases in self-control scores after just 10 hours of intervention for 4 and 5-year-olds.
10 hours, that's not a lot.
No, it highlights that training attention and emotional regulation can be achieved in these relatively short, focused bursts.
Music training also showed up as a booster, which is another one of those non-obvious connections.
It did. An intensive 20-day music training program for 4 to 6-year-olds led to significant enhancements in their verbal intelligence and also observable changes to brain indices of EF.
Why music?
Well, music demands rhythmic control, auditory working memory, and the inhibition of irrelevant sounds. And beyond that, even the simplest interventions like structured physical activity are also essential. A meta-analysis confirmed that physical activity can significantly enhance EF development, although the effectiveness depends on things like the child's age and the specific duration and intensity of the movement.
Right. Let's confront the great debate, the one that stresses out parents and teachers everywhere. It's this perceived trade-off between play and academics. Do we choose rigor through worksheets or joy through unstructured activities?
Mm-hmm.
The research seems to suggest this choice is based on a fundamental misunderstanding of what rigor actually is for a 5-year-old.
It's a false dichotomy. The data definitively calls it a false dichotomy. The key distinction we need to make is between guided play, direct instruction, and free play.
Right. Three different things.
Three very different things. A major systematic review and meta-analysis of 39 studies directly compared guided play to traditional direct instruction for children younger than 8.
And what did they find? Which one was more effective?
The data really speaks for itself. Guided play showed greater positive effects than direct instruction across several key academic and process domains. For early math skills, the advantage was moderate and meaningful, and effect size of G equals 0.24.
Okay.
For shape knowledge, which, remember, connects back to spatial reasoning and that math amplifier, the advantage for guided play jumped significantly to G equals 0.63. And crucially, for process skills like task switching, which is a measure of cognitive flexibility, the guided play advantage was G equals 0.40.
So we have real quantitative evidence that guided play is not just equally effective, but in many cases, it's demonstrably more effective for teaching abstract concepts and process skills to young children than sitting them down for a lecture.
It creates a state of active, sustained engagement that demands cognitive control in a way that passive listening doesn't. Now, the research does support a balanced approach.
Mm-hmm.
You can embed brief, strategic moments of direct instruction for really isolated skills like learning the sounds of the alphabet or phonological awareness, but you integrate that within a rich, discovery-based play environment.
Yeah.
The sweet spot is that discovery-based guided play. It results in increased learning for all children compared to both pure free play and pure direct instruction.
So what about simple, unstructured free play? Does that still serve a purpose if guided play is so effective for academics?
Free play is absolutely vital. It's crucial for emotional processing, social negotiation, and developing intrinsic motivation. A large Australian longitudinal study, it tracked over 2,000 children, found that the amount of time spent in unstructured, quiet, and active play at ages 2 to 5 significantly predicted their self-regulation abilities years later.
So guided play targets specific cognitive goals, but free play is where they consolidate those skills in a social context.
Exactly. It provides the necessary space for social emotional development.
Okay, now let's turn to what is probably the most controversial finding in this whole deep dive.
Right.
The early reading paradox. The societal pressure to accelerate reading is just immense.
It's everywhere.
But the long-term data raises some really serious questions about the costs of that acceleration.
It really does. So let's look at the catch-up effect first. There was a New Zealand study that compared children who started formal reading instruction at age 7 in a Steiner school model to kids who started at age 5 in a typical model.
And what happened?
By age 11, the children who started later had caught up completely. There was no long-term difference in their reading ability, which suggests that for typically developing kids, rushing the process offers no measurable, sustained advantage.
Okay, that's reassuring. But the next finding, from the Terman Life Cycle Study, is the truly shocking reversal. Now, this study is famous. It tracked gifted individuals for 8 decades. What did it reveal about the association between reading early and lifelong success?
This finding is the ultimate red flag about developmental mismatch. The Terman study found that while, yes, early reading was associated with early academic success, it was also associated with less lifelong educational attainment and worse midlife adjustment.
Wait. Less education and worse adjustment. How is that even possible?
Well, the researchers offer a few speculations. None of them are definitive proof of causation, but they point to some critical issues. One theory is that children who are pushed prematurely into formal academics might develop a fixed mindset about learning.
A focus on status, not trajectory.
Exactly. The pressure of constant, rigid academic performance at such an early age may sacrifice the development of those crucial process skills, like persistence and resilience, which are better fostered through self-directed, structured play.
So they might become great early readers, but poor long-term learners.
That's the idea. They optimize for content mastery at the expense of their process skill development. And what's more, the Terman study revealed an even more striking, though very complex, association. Early school entry was associated with an increased mortality risk among this high-achieving group.
That's unsettling.
It is. Now, the causal chain is murky, but it suggests that sacrificing developmentally appropriate time for play and maturation for the sake of early academics might have significant long-term costs to an individual's well-being and psychological health.
This really emphasizes the need to distinguish between pushing all kids to accelerate versus providing targeted intervention for students who are genuinely struggling.
Absolutely. The context here matters hugely. The research is clear that targeted, high-quality interventions for struggling readers, those with clear readiness deficits, show positive outcomes. We're talking a weighted mean effect size of 0.39.
So for kids who need the help, early intervention is good.
It's beneficial. The red flags are the universal implementation of formal academics before a child is ready, an excessive reliance on worksheets and rote memorization, and critically, sacrificing the time that's needed for play and social-emotional development.
So if the extremes, pure rote academics on one side or pure aimless free play on the other, are both problematic for different reasons, what does a successful middle path actually look like?
The Montessori case study offers a really powerful example of how you can synthesize rigor and developmental appropriateness.
How so?
The Montessori method is characterized by self-directed, purposeful, hands-on tasks that just naturally demand executive function. Children are given these long, uninterrupted blocks of time to engage in complex, self-chosen activities.
And what does the hard evidence, the randomized controlled trial evidence, show about this model?
An extensive RCT found significant advantages favoring the Montessori program over the control groups on both academic and social measures after 30 months. But what was really striking was the equity effect.
What do you mean?
Montessori education elevated performance for all the children, but it also made the income-based achievement gaps much smaller than the gaps that were observed in the control groups.
That is a powerful finding. Why would that approach specifically narrow the achievement gap?
The thinking is that the high-quality, hands-on materials and the focus on independent, scaffolded work inherently target and strengthen executive function. And since EF is a key mechanism through which socioeconomic disadvantage often manifests, strengthening that EF system through these demanding and rigorous activities is an incredibly effective strategy for giving lower SES children the cognitive tools they need to succeed.
And is there long-term proof of the model?
There is. Graduates from public Montessori programs in Milwaukee public schools had significantly higher math and science scores in 10th and 12th grades than their demographically matched peers who were in traditional public schools. It confirms that you can prioritize developmentally appropriate process skills and rigor in the early years without sacrificing long-term content mastery.
Okay, we've spent all this time establishing that these high-leverage interventions can create massive gains in EF and early academic skills. But now we have to face the hard reality of the fade-out phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to these impressive achievements once the child moves beyond that crucial early window?
This is a critical finding, and it's led to a lot of skepticism about the value of early childhood programs. A meta-analysis of full-day kindergarten programs found that the positive effects on measurable academic achievement that you see at the end of the kindergarten year,
yeah,
they completely diminish by the end of third grade.
And the gains just evaporate.
Content gains fade.
So is the investment pointless then? Sure. Why does this happen?
The intervention is far from pointless. But what this reveals is the fragility of early content knowledge when it's faced with inconsistent subsequent instruction. If a child masters phonics in a great kindergarten, but then moves to a first grade class that's focused purely on worksheets with very low EF demands, those early academic gains are not going to be reinforced, and they'll likely fade. The system failed to sustain the momentum.
But, and this is the key insight, right?
Mm-hmm.
While that measurable content fades, something else persists. The child's fundamental capacity has changed.
Exactly. The benefit shifts from these transient achievement gains to a persistent capacity for navigating the system. What actually sticks are the outcomes that reflect the child's improved ability to engage with the educational system and to control their own behavior.
So what outcomes reliably persist long term? What's the proof that this early EF training fundamentally changed how a child navigates school for years to come?
We see the most consistent, robust, long-term effects on these systemic outcomes that relate directly to persistence, self-control, and long-term goal orientation. So these effects include significant reductions in grade retention rates.
And you held back a year.
Right. An effect size of D equals 0.2, 6 standard deviations, which translates to a powerful 8.3 percentage point reduction in the likelihood of being held back.
An 8.3 percentage point reduction based on a pre-K program. That is huge, both for the individual child and for a school system's resources.
It is. We also see robust reductions in special education placement. That's a D of 0.33, an 8.1 percentage point reduction. The ability to regulate your attention and behavior often keeps a child out of that special ed referral process in the first place.
And the ultimate outcome.
The ultimate outcome. We see persistent increases in high school graduation rates. An effect size at D equals 0.24, which is an 11.4 percentage point increase.
And the Abecedarian Project, which has been running for decades now, it confirms this focus on long-term systemic outcomes, right?
Absolutely. The Abecedarian Project found that the participants who received that high-quality early intervention were 4 times more likely to hold a bachelor's degree by age 30, and they were consistently more likely to be employed throughout their adult lives. The takeaway is this. Early EF intervention does not guarantee mastery of third grade content, but it gives the child the tools, the persistence, the mastery orientation, the ability to self-correct, to continuously benefit from and navigate the entire educational pipeline for decades.
This persistence of process skills versus the fading of content mastery, it creates this massive policy mismatch. And this is central to the problem we set out to address at the very beginning.
Yeah.
What does the research show matters most versus what our institutions actually measure and reward?
There is a deep systemic divergence. The research, like the findings from the Udome Initiative, overwhelmingly shows that the highest leverage variables are self-regulation, executive function, approaches to learning, and crucially, the fidelity of implementation. These are the things that predict lifelong trajectory.
And yet, what determines school funding, teacher evaluations, and public reporting?
Short-term content mastery metrics, easily assessed end-of-year reading and math benchmarks. And while almost every state has now adopted pre-K social and emotional learning standards on paper,
right,
the lack of corresponding political incentives or accountability measures or financial rewards really limits the true investment and the teacher training. So we're focusing all this institutional energy on achieving these transient academic gains that we know fade by third grade, while we underinvest in the complex long-term development of the process skills that we know persist into adulthood.
So this policy mismatch creates systemic pressure on educators to prioritize the short-term win, the measurable content score, over the much more complex, difficult to measure long-term development of a truly self-regulated, persistent learner. The incentives are completely backwards.
Okay, this deep dive has, I think, fundamentally shifted the focus from something like early reading to something more like cognitive resilience. To summarize the core findings from the UDAME Research Kindergarten from First Principles Initiative for our listener, let's just synthesize the 2 or 3 most critical, highest leverage variables that we need to be focusing on for ages 4 to 6.
Okay, first, without a doubt, executive function development. This is the non-negotiable cognitive amplifier. It's highly malleable in this window, and its development predicts those 25 distinct outcomes across the entire lifespan, from health to employment. Every single minute of the instructional day should be assessed based on whether it is intentionally challenging and strengthening working memory, inhibitory control, and cognitive flexibility.
Second, the surprising academic lever, early math skills.
Yes.
Early math skills are the strongest academic predictor of later success, even stronger than reading. But the crucial insight is that bidirectional relationship. High-quality math instruction focused on spatial reasoning and complex patterning, delivered through guided play, doesn't just deliver content, it actively demands and strengthens EF development. Math is the workout for the EF system.
And third, the thing that translates the science into reality, implementation quality.
The fidelity of implementation is the success variable. It's the whole ball game. We saw the same curriculum yield effect sizes from 0.0 to 0.8. The curriculum itself is useless without deeply trained, reflective teachers who understand the mechanism of the intervention, why they're asking children to plan their play, why they're using specific language, and why they must tolerate the productive struggle that actually builds EF.
And while that high-quality instruction is key, we know that environmental factors, both at home and in the classroom, are prerequisites for a child to even be able to deploy their ES skills. So let's quickly review the critical, non-curricular environmental supports that emerged from the research.
Right. The child's stable environment provides the bandwidth for this kind of complex cognitive training. First and foremost, sleep. The research showed that fewer behavioral sleep problems, like frequent night waking or difficulty falling asleep, significantly predicted better self-regulation development from ages 4 to 7. Sleep quality is just foundational to frontal lobe function.
And what about parental behavior?
Parenting style is highly predictive. Lower levels of both maternal and paternal angry parenting predicted better self-regulation outcomes. We also see that things like maternal anxiety and depression are associated with increased odds for poor self-regulation in the child. The emotional climate of the home provides the safety and predictability that a child needs to practice behavioral control.
And finally, the physical classroom environment itself. What matters there?
Two structural factors are critical. First, nature exposure. It shows small but statistically significant positive associations with self-regulation. This suggests that access to natural environments can help mitigate environmental disadvantages, particularly for lower SES children. And second, class size and ratios. For classrooms that already have low ratios, like 7.5 to 1 or lower, reducing the ratio by just one child per teacher, predicted a Bi-A2 standard deviation greater effect size on outcomes. It just illustrates that smaller groups provide more of the individualized scaffolding that's necessary for real EF training.
You know, this whole deep dive has really established a profound truth for me. The developmental imperative for ages 4 to 6 isn't about choosing between academics and play or between content and process. We've demonstrated that they're not opposing forces at all.
They're mutually reinforcing elements of optimal development. We shouldn't be asking if a child is ready for math. We should be asking how we can use challenging, developmentally rigorous math to make them cognitively ready for life.
Right.
And by aligning our practice to that reality, by prioritizing the process skills that provide that sustained, systemic navigation capacity over transient content mastery, that's how we unlock true long-term potential for every single child.
I think the ultimate lesson here is that the most powerful thing we can give a child is the tool set for continuous learning, for adaptation, and for persistence throughout their lives. And that tool set is executive function.
And that really brings us to the end of this deep dive. I think for me, the biggest aha moments really centered on the realization that early math skills are that single strongest academic predictor, the absolute necessity of implementation fidelity to avoid that 0.0 effect size paradox, and just the profound power of process skills, executive function, and approaches to learning and determining a child's long-term trajectory over their initial academic status.
If you are looking to explore the mechanics and the mechanisms behind these findings yourself, you can find the full research report that formed the basis of this deep dive at research.yuda.me. That's Yuda.me. We encourage you to explore the sources and join us next time for another deep dive.